Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Because the reality is, they need to eat. And that's our philosophy across all of our programs, even in our dining room for our evening meal. If you need the food, we're not going to question why you need the food.
Vicki Pierce of the Community Kitchen of Monroe County. We take a ride in the van that delivers food to kids living in low-income areas around town. Harvest Public Media has a story for us about the beautiful but fleeting blooms on the orchid cactus. Fresh fruit plus meringue equals a lovely dessert with Chef Daniel Orr. And author Jonathan Bloom writes about food waste, where it comes from and what we can do about it. Our conversation with him from last fall also coming up today on Earth Eats. A look at food-related news. First off, Luann Johnson brings it to us.
With the expiration date on partially hydrogenated oils, or trans fats, looming, food manufacturers are scrambling to find out what will take their place. Partially hydrogenated oils are solid at room temperature and provide longevity to processed foods, but it's the texture and mouthfeel that trans fats provide food that could prove difficult to replace. One proposed solution has environmentalists incredibly worried. Palm oil. When the FDA initially ruled in 2006 that trans fats must be labeled, palm oil imports jumped 60%. However, palm oil cultivation is a leading cause of deforestation. Genetically engineered oils could potentially replace trans fats. A company called Solazyme makes genetically modified algae that produces oil, and Monsanto is working on an engineered soybean that produces less fattening oil. With 3 years to phase out trans fats, food manufacturers have time to develop and reformulate oils. The FDA has estimated the cost to the food industry will be about $6.2 billion, a small fraction of the public health savings estimated at $140 billion. To save water in drought-stricken California, Nestle will renovate its 9 facilities in the state to reduce or eliminate their use of water. The Nestle USA milk factory in Modesto, California, will also be transformed into a zero-water facility, saving an estimated 63 million gallons of water per year. The Swiss company has already opened a zero-water plant in Mexico, where the milk plant extracts all necessary water from raw ingredients. Nestle anticipates the Modesto zero-water facility will be finished by the end of 2016. And a House bill to block states from requiring labels on genetically engineered foods is set to reach the chamber floor by the end of next month. Supporters say they have the votes to get it passed. Kansas Representative Mike Pompeo introduced the Safe and Accurate Labeling Act in 2014. The bill would create a USDA certification program for voluntary non-GMO labels, much like the organic label system. Last week, a provision was added to a draft of the bill that would prevent states from passing their own GMO label requirements. It would also nullify Vermont's mandatory GMO labels that are slated to go into effect next year. The House Agriculture Committee will hold a hearing on the bill this week, but it must also get through the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Both committees will have a chance to modify the bill's language. Find links to these stories at eartheats.org. They're listed as part of the latest post on the website.
Luann, the voice of our news. Always fun.
Thanks, Annie.
It's summer, and flowers are blooming here in the Midwest. More than just a pretty time of year, bloom season is the elaborate mating dance plants do to draw pollinators close. Blossoms can last weeks, but for some species, the ritual takes place over the course of just a few hours. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell has more.
Tonight is bloom night. Linda Zellmer perches on a stool, gazing at the swollen bud of an orchid cactus.
I wish it would move a little faster. But it's slowly opening.
Zellmer is a librarian at Western Illinois University. In addition to shelving lots of books, her library houses thousands of potted plants, including a 100-year-old jade specimen and a 15-foot-tall fig tree. But the most alluring plants the library houses are 3 orchid cacti, known to botanists as Epiphyllum oxypetalum. Admirers nickname it Queen of the Night, or Lady of the Night, because it blooms in the dark and each bud opens just one night a year.
When it opens up, you can smell it, like this whole area will smell like this flower. You know, sometimes it gets to the point that it's really overpowering.
This particular lady of the night lives a solitary life, rooted in a small pot under the shadow of an umbrella tree. But tonight is its one chance to do what it was meant to do, spread its seeds. A few weeks ago, the cactus pushed out a single bright green bud that hung down from its fleshy stem. Zelmer photographed as it extended 4 inches long. Then, she says, it stood up, eager for birds and bugs to swoop in and collect some of its pollen.
The stem that the flower is on literally hooks up like a shepherd's hook. And right now the flower is so heavy that it's just laying on the floor.
In its native habitat, stretching from the subtropics of Mexico to the rainforests of South America, the orchid cactus would never touch the ground. Instead, it clings to the branch of a tree 40 to 60 feet up. It can grow 20 feet tall, wrapping its roots around the tree's trunk and feeding on sunlight, rain, and air. Perched in the rainforest canopy, the flower blooms bathed in moonlight amidst the whirl and buzz of nighttime creature life. The library is silent.
It's just relaxing. It's quiet in here at night.
It's approaching 10 o'clock, and finally it starts to happen. First, the bud's outermost petals peel back, wiry and pink. Then the middle layers fringe and part, long and thin like a piano player's hand.
It opened up a little bit more.
You can smell it now, too.
Soon, the flower's central blossom balloons and its wide opal petals start to unravel. By full bloom, they'll stretch to the size of a dinner plate, revealing a beaming white, almost iridescent center.
It looks like a little spider in the middle, but it's this pure white, and it smells wonderful.
At this point, the blossom is literally throwing off heat. Its warmth, a siren's call to the forest's hummingbirds, bats, and moths. Come, I'm ready, you can imagine it scream. If the orchid is lucky, one of these creatures will be covered in pollen from another orchid cactus. As the creature dips into the petals for a drink, the pollen will brush off and trickle into the flower's center, fertilizing the tapioca-like embryos inside. Then, the plant can bear forth a big red fruit, filled with orchid cactus seeds.
Ours have never produced fruit because they never get pollinated. In the wild, they do produce some sort of fruit.
A little before midnight, Zelmer packs up and heads off. By the time she returns tomorrow morning, the blossom will be spent, and the cactus will look like just another plant in the library. That is, until next year. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
See a photo of the flower and listen to this story again at harvestpublicmedia.org. Americans waste more than 40% of the food we produce for consumption. That comes to an annual cost of more than $100 billion. To go behind these staggering numbers, we speak with author Jonathan Bloom. He's been researching and writing about food waste since 2005. He's the author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It.
In terms of not eating broccoli stalks or eating the florets instead, and I think of asparagus heads in the same manner, I think that's just a preference that has developed over the years. And unfortunately, we've reached this point where now not only do we want to only eat certain parts of food, we don't want to eat anything that doesn't look perfect. And there's this superficiality that has developed in American culture in regard to food.
What can we do to just change consumers' desires or expectations?
Yeah, I think there are a few things here. And first of all, we as consumers do have a role to play, and we can voice our opinions on not needing food to look perfect and not requiring that homogeneity in our food supply. And I think that is that word and that concept is a little more important than just focusing on blemishes or damaged goods, because I think there are two categories here. The fresh market in our country requires things to be the exact same shape, size, and color. And if anything doesn't meet one of those three requirements, it tends to get tossed. And so if we as consumers voice to the stores that we want those items, we're fine with a cucumber that's a little bit curved or a banana that's straight, then there will be a follow-through. And from an economic standpoint, why would those producers want to throw away as much as they now do?
And sometimes at farmers markets, if you ask vendors, do you have tomatoes that are maybe not so pretty that I could turn into sauce? I know that's an option for some people.
Yeah, it's pretty common to buy seconds, and the sauce tomato being the classic example. But I like to go to vendors and ask them if they have any funky-looking vegetables, because I think those kind of foods have a little more character. So some people use the word ugly to connote that it looks different, but I like to call it quirky fruits and vegetables. And mostly it's a way of having fun, but also hopefully communicating that all food is edible, and let's try to lower our standards on appearance a bit.
Author Jonathan Bloom thinks about food waste all the time. He'll talk about his own cooking and shopping habits later on. Connect with him on Twitter @WastedFood.
All right, something sweet
on earth eats to die, darlings.
Our recipe with Chef Daniel Orr will be broken up into a couple pieces today. It's a meringue, essentially, but really it's a fancy way to enjoy some seasonal fruit. If you're the impatient type, you can see the recipe and photos of the finished product at eartheats.org. For the rest of us, here's step one.
You know, it has the wow factor of a baked Alaska without all the extra work. All you gotta do is make the meringue. All right, so what I'm doing is I've got my mixing bowl going. You could also use a hand beater if you wanted to, or if you want to get a little exercise, you could use a whisk. One thing you always want to remember is that egg whites need to be completely fat-free when you whisk them, otherwise they will not form foam. You have to make sure all the yolk, any evidence of the yolk, is out of there, and that you use a very clean bowl. The other thing a lot of people get mixed up in the kitchen is that you never want to whip warm cream, because it'll turn to butter, and you always want to keep everything as cold as possible. Just the opposite for egg whites. You want to have them room temperature, and you want to have a warm bowl. Okay, to the cup of egg whites, we're going to add 1.5 cups of granulated sugar. And this is what's going to form a meringue.
And now we wait.
Yep.
Several minutes to get the meringue nice and stiff. You'll look for the sugar to be completely dissolved and for the egg whites to form peaks when you remove the whisks. Chef Orr back in the second half of the show to show us what comes next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. This is Earth Eats. Welcome.
All right, so we have our meringue made, which is the simple egg white and sugar base. Probably took about 5 minutes to get nice and light.
Daniel Orr working on our fruity meringue dessert.
We're going to spray our gratin dish, our baking dish. You want to have something that's oven-proof for this, and individual dishes are best. And so we're going to cut up some fruit. All right, so I probably have got about an apricot and a half, two or three strawberries in there. I'm going to spoon over the meringue and mainly keep that towards the middle of the dish so the fruit's exposed on the exterior. Okay, I'm going to stick a couple raspberries down in the meringue. And then you want to have your broiler set on high, and I'm going to take this over and put it under the broiler. And what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of keep this down on a lower level. We want the fruit to get slightly warm, and we're going to cook this until the meringue really starts to get brown and caramelizes on top. That should take about 3 to 5 minutes.
Jonathan Bloom has been following the food waste story for over 10 years. He came into the Earth Eats studios last fall to talk about how food insecurity and obesity can be tied back to food waste. Let's look at food waste that comes from farms. He points out three reasons food doesn't make it to consumers.
Oftentimes, with hand-picked fruits and vegetables, it's appearance. Sometimes it's economics of not having the money to pay for a harvesting crew to go through twice. So maybe it's just going through and picking what's ripe at a certain time. And then there are other reasons where you'll see entire fields unharvested because maybe the price of that good doesn't justify the harvest.
Food left in the fields, that can be fixed by gleaning. It's an ancient practice of going into the fields and harvesting crops left behind. It's changed a bit over the years, according to Bloom. It used to be that farmers would leave a corner of the field untouched as a form of charity. People in need would then pick the unharvested food for themselves. These days, gleaning looks like volunteers going out into the fields to pick food and then donating the harvest to hunger organizations. Bloom says gardeners can apply this idea to their harvest as well.
Let's say if you have squash planted, you're probably going to have too much. Well, there's a great opportunity to make friends in your community, to do some sharing with neighbors or friends, maybe even some trading. And it's a nice way to build community while avoiding waste and putting good food to use.
Or you can donate that extra harvest to your local soup kitchen or food pantry. He points out that nearly 50 million Americans are food insecure.
That juxtaposition of waste and hunger is something that I would call morally callous. To know about the levels of hunger in America and then continue to squander about 25% of the food we bring home, that system and that habit doesn't make sense. So if you know of those two coexisting statistics, then maybe it would be easier for you to make a change in the portions you serve to family and friends. Or maybe it's buying less food at the supermarket if you know you're going to not use almost a quarter of that food.
Well, let's talk about restaurants then. So ordering less food and then taking home your leftovers and actually eating them. A couple ways to reduce your personal food waste footprint. How else can we interact with restaurants to let them know that, look, food waste is not okay anymore, and as a consumer, I want you to address it?
Yeah, I think you've hit on the two main factors, but portion size is such a massive factor in wasting food, and we're often put into this terrible situation where we get served too much food and we can either overeat or waste. Now, there is a better way or a third way, which would be to take home leftovers. But you know, some people don't like leftovers. Some people might not be going straight home. So more often than not, it's either overeating or waste. And so here's a case where massive portions being a common symptom for two problems of overeating and the obesity crisis and the food waste crisis that we're now starting to pay attention to. From my perspective, it's really a case of getting restaurants to offer more choice and really changing the notion of value at a restaurant. What is getting your money's worth at a restaurant? What does that look like these days?
So let's look to the future with author Jonathan Bloom. Think ahead maybe to your next book or in 10 years, whatever seems like the most realistic future date. What's this conversation about food waste going to be like then?
The next major topic of conversation, in my view, will be about banning food from landfills. And you're starting to see that kind of policy shift already at the state level. But then on a more social level, I would imagine that individuals will be called upon to make a change in their own lives. That's important because we often think of ourselves as not having agency in these environmental issues. But when you look at where food waste is happening, the two largest sources are farms and homes. So we are creating a decent amount ourselves, but when you lump it all together, it really adds up to a lot.
Jonathan Bloom, he's the author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food, and What We Can Do About It. Jonathan, it's been great. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, I've had a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Hear our complete conversation at eartheats.org. It's 7:30 in the morning, and the community kitchen of Monroe County is already bustling with activity. Heather James and four volunteers are packing paper bags for the kitchen's summer breakfast program. By 9, two vans will leave the kitchen to deliver these meals to kids in low-income neighborhoods around the area. James and her crew are right on schedule.
Okay. You guys can put the oranges in there while I do the bologna sandwiches.
They pack lunches, too. Today, it's 80 bags with bologna sandwiches, milk, juice, and an orange.
Yesterday, they actually had peanut butter white chocolate scones, which were amazing.
Vicki Pierce is the executive director of the Community Kitchen of Monroe County. Those scones, by the way, were made in-house, and they do that a couple times a week as a special treat for the kids. Pierce says they looked at the numbers of kids receiving free or reduced lunches during the school year to determine which neighborhoods to put on their summer delivery route. In total, 9 neighborhoods in both Bloomington and Ellettsville, where they serve about 100 kids.
Oh, you know what? We're not ready. We don't have Boys and Girls Club food. It's our first stop.
Ben Myers is driving the van they call the ice cream truck. He parks it in a central location, like a playground, and the kids can just run up to the van, grab some food, and go. It's a bit more complicated than that at certain locations, but we'll get to that in a second.
We're going up to the Crestmont Boys and Girls Club to drop off their breakfasts and lunches. Do you want the radio off while we're doing this? Okay.
Because it's challenging to express what it's like for a lot of these kids to go out firsthand and experience it, it's eye-opening.
That's Tim Clower, assistant director of the kitchen. He's the one who makes connections with the mobile home directors and apartment managers to get permission to do the deliveries. He also worked with schools to get flyers into kids' hands before the school year ended. They serve anyone under 18, but the majority of the kids who take advantage of the free food are under 12.
I got a big one.
Okay. I got one more.
I want to. I'll take it.
We'll go see if they have any empties for us to take back.
Yep, they have some, I think. Yep.
About 37% of students in Monroe County received free or reduced lunches this past school year, according to the Indiana Youth Institute. That translates to about 5,200 kids. Pierce says some of these kids are eating breakfast and lunch at school.
And so that means in the summer when they're at home, two things are happening. They are potentially at a nutritional disadvantage because they're not getting those two meals a day at school that are well-balanced and meeting their needs. And in addition, their family's food budgets are going to be stretched so much more tightly than they are during the school year.
Whoa, we got kids already. Hey, guys. How's it going? Here, do you want to hand out meals and I'll mark them down on the sheet?
We're now at Lindsay Hayes Trailer Court in Ellettsville, Indiana. Three kids are waiting for the van to pull over. Myers gets out a wicker picnic blanket and sets it down on a patch of overgrown grass and gravel. Some kids take their breakfast to go. Three kids stick around.
We are hanging out. Raisin bran. Juice. Apple juice. And white milk. This is all we have.
We stay at each site for 15 minutes, then it's on to the next. The kitchen paid for this program out of its own budget for years. They now receive funding from the Summer Food Service Program of the Indiana Department of Education. With that funding comes some hoops to jump through.
We'll need to keep track of how many kids eat here with us, as well as how many kids we hand a meal to and just take them home.
Myers is making tally marks on a clipboard. The funding is intended to support congregate meals, where everyone comes to one location and workers make sure the kids are the ones eating the food. At this stop, Highland Park Elementary, everyone needs to sit on the blanket and eat the food while we're here.
Who wants to be on the radio?
Kids, why did we come to the breakfast truck?
To have breakfast.
Chanel Earle has been bringing her three kids to this delivery spot for four summers. They're 2, 4, and 6 years old.
This is like brunch.
It is. It's late enough in the day that they already had a small breakfast this morning. Here's your milk.
Two of Earl's kids eat meals provided by their schools, so the summer months are tough on her budget.
I mean, if you think about three kids, five breakfasts a week, that adds up to a lot of money really fast. And we can handle it. We would feed our kids if this wasn't here. They wouldn't go hungry.
At first, she thought her family didn't qualify for this program because, as she put it, they aren't starving. But Pierce says no one has to prove their need to be welcomed into the community kitchen.
Because the reality is they need to eat. And that's our philosophy across all of our programs, even in our dining room for our evening meal. If you need the food, we're not going to question why you need the food.
What's most important, she says, is removing barriers.
Bye. Just slide it back that way. Perfect.
I'll reach you.
Thanks to Ben Myers, Tim Clower, Vicki Pierce, and everyone at the Community Kitchen of Monroe County. Listen to this story again at eartheats.org. One last step to complete our very fancy fruit meringue dish with Chef Daniel Orr. Now we're back by the broiler.
And you can see that it's starting to caramelize.
You're watching this like a hawk, no wonder.
Yeah, it goes from brown to black in 30 seconds flat.
Oh, and it's steaming now. All right.
See, we got a little bit of dark color on it. All right, to finish this, you know, this is kind of gilding the lily, but I'm going to add a little bitter orange sauce, garnish it with some candied orange peel, and a little bit of fresh mint. And that's a really elegant, wonderful summer dish. Looks complicated, ends up being fairly simple.
And it tastes really great. This recipe and the photos are at eartheats.org. Our crew of Earth Eaters are Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. A beautiful June day to you. Thanks for making Earth Eats a part of it. I'm Annie Corrigan.